All right, so get ready.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's time for us to deep dive into some fascinating biblical detective work.
I love it.
Our listeners have sent us a ton of research on who actually wrote the book of Deuteronomy.
That's a big question.
It is a big question.
Yeah.
And it's a lot more exciting than it sounds at first. Trust me.
Oh, absolutely. It's a captivating puzzle for sure. And you know, it really matters.
Yeah.
Because Deuteronomy is kind of like the Constitution of the Old Testament.
Okay.
It lays the groundwork for so much.
Yeah.
Figuring out who wrote it.
Yeah.
Has massive implications for how we understand the whole thing.
Okay. So for centuries, pretty much everyone just kind of assumed that Moses wrote Deuteronomy.
Makes sense.
It seems pretty straightforward because it says so right there in the text.
It does.
But then in the 1800s, this scholar named Julius Wellhausen comes along.
Oh, I've heard of him.
And really shakes things up.
Big time.
He proposed this theory called the documentary hypothesis.
Which is a mouthful.
It is a mouthful.
Yeah.
We'll explain it more in a bit.
Okay, good.
But basically what it argues is that Deuteronomy was actually written much later.
Hmm.
Around 621 BC.
Okay, so like centuries later.
Yeah, centuries later.
Wow, that's a big difference.
Huge difference.
Yeah.
And his theory, I mean, it really took off.
It did. It became really influential.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Housen essentially said that the Bible wasn't written all at once.
Okay.
But kind of evolved over time with different authors and editors adding to it over the centuries.
Interesting.
So he thought Deuteronomy was kind of a much later addition reflecting the religious ideas of a very different era.
I see. So not Moses's time.
Right. Right.
But much later.
Exactly. But here's the thing.
Yeah.
Even with Wellhausen's theory kind of becoming the dominant view in scholarship, there were always these scholars who weren't convinced.
Like, hold on. Yeah. There's more to this story.
Exactly. They're like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Let's not jump to conclusion.
Moses might still be in the picture.
Exactly. So they kept the debate alive.
Good for them.
They were arguing that Moses really was the author of Deuteronomy.
Interesting.
And get this. In the last 25 years or so.
Oh, really?
There's been this resurgence of research.
Like a comeback.
Yeah, a comeback.
Prosaic authorship.
That supports this traditional view.
That's fascinating.
It really is.
So it's like a case that went cold for a while?
Yeah, exactly.
But now new evidence is emerging.
Yeah.
Pointing in a different direction.
I love that analogy.
That's a good one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's so cool is we have this whole team of scholars now.
Well, a whole team.
With their own expertise.
Awesome.
Bringing fresh perspectives to this debate.
I like it.
It's like a forensic team coming in to re-examine all the evidence.
Nice.
Right.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. And they're finding some really intriguing things.
Like, well, I'm hooked.
Okay, so first up, we have this Dutch scholar named Halwerda.
Okay.
And he tackles one of the key pieces of evidence
that
Wellhausen used to argue for a late date.
Okay.
For Deuteronomy.
We did.
This idea of centralized worship.
Okay, yeah, I've heard of that.
Yeah, so Wellhausen said that Deuteronomy mandated that everyone had to worship in one central location.
Right.
Which was an idea that didn't become prominent until much later in Israeli history.
Got it.
But Halwerda says, hold on a second.
Not so fast.
Not so fast.
All right.
He really digs deep
into
Deuteronomy chapter 12.
Okay.
Which is the passage Wellhausen pointed to.
Right.
And his analysis is fascinating.
I bet.
He argues that this chapter isn't about mandating exclusive worship at one central location.
Interesting.
But about purifying worship practices.
Okay.
So instead of saying you can only worship at this one spot,
right?
Deuteronomy is saying get rid of those Canaanite idols.
Oh, okay.
And don't copy their rituals.
Gotcha. Stay true to the one true God.
Yes.
It's not about the place.
It's not about geography.
It's about the practice.
Exactly.
I like it.
And that is a game changer.
It is, because it undercuts a major pillar of Wellhausen's argument for a late dating.
Yeah.
So if Deuteronomy isn't mandating centralized worship in the way Wellhausen thought, then that whole link to King Josiah's reforms in 621 BC.
Right.
Just falls apart.
It falls apart.
It's gone.
It's like in those crime dramas.
Oh, I love those.
Where they think they have the suspect.
Yeah.
But then new evidence emerges.
plot twist.
Total plot twist.
They have to rethink the whole case.
And they have to rethink the whole case.
Wow, I love it.
And that's what these scholars are doing.
It's so exciting.
They're reexamining the evidence. They're questioning assumptions. And they're coming up with new interpretations.
That's what scholarship is all about.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right, so Halerta throws a wrench.
He does.
In Wellhausen's theory, with this analysis of centralized worship.
Big wrench.
But then we have another scholar, Manley,
yeah,
who takes a completely different approach.
All right, bring it on.
He's like a code breaker.
Oh, cool.
Okay.
Yeah.
He focuses on the law codes in different parts of the Pentateuch.
Pentateuch.
That's the first five books of the Bible.
Right, which includes Deuteronomy.
Exactly, including Deuteronomy.
Okay.
He's looking for signs of how the law developed over time.
Makes sense.
So Wellhausen's theory predicted that the law would have evolved from simpler to more complex over centuries.
Right, you'd expect to see stages of development, right?
Right.
In different parts of the Pentateuch.
Exactly, it's like if you were studying the evolution of language.
Okay, yeah.
You'd expect to see older, simpler forms of language in the earlier texts. And then more complex forms in later texts.
That makes sense.
Right.
Yeah.
But here's the thing.
What is it?
Manley's research doesn't actually support that idea.
Oh, really?
When it comes to the Pentateuch.
That's interesting.
He finds all these overlaps and echoes and connections between the law codes in these different sections.
Okay.
Regardless of when Wellhausen thought they were written.
Fascinating.
It's like finding similar architectural styles.
Oh, I get it.
In different parts of a city.
Right.
You wouldn't necessarily think that one building was built centuries after another.
Right. They could have been built around the same time.
Right.
Reflecting a shared style.
Exactly. Reflecting a shared architectural vision.
It's like they had the same blueprint.
Yes.
Interesting.
So Manley is basically saying that the law codes look more like an interconnected web than a linear evolution.
That's a great way to put it.
And that's a pretty big challenge to the idea
that
Deuteronomy was just this late addition to the biblical text.
Totally changes the game.
It really does. Yeah. And it gets even more fascinating when we bring in our next scholar.
Oh, who's that?
Klein.
Okay, Klein.
And he's all about form criticism.
Form criticism. What is that?
Okay, so time out for a quick explanation for our listeners.
Good idea.
Form criticism is basically looking at the structure and style of a text.
Okay.
To try to understand its genre and purpose.
Okay.
It's like comparing a sonnet to a haiku.
Oh, okay.
They're both poetry. But they follow different rules and they have different effects.
Right. Different forms, different purposes.
Exactly.
Okay, I get it.
So Klein, our form critic detective.
Love it.
He looks at Deuteronomy.
Yeah.
And he says, hey, this looks a lot like those ancient treaties that Hittite kings used to make.
Hittite treaties? What are those?
With their vassals.
I've never heard of those.
Oh, they're amazing.
Okay.
Okay, so Hittite treaties, think of them like contracts.
Contracts, okay.
From ancient Anatolia.
Okay, so way back.
Like way back.
Got it.
Yeah.
But what do those have to do with the Bible?
That's what's so mind-blowing.
Okay, tell me.
Klein found all these striking parallels between the structure of Deuteronomy and the standard elements of a Hittite treaty.
Wow.
And guess what? These treaties date back to the time of Moses, not to 621 BC.
Oh, what?
It's like finding a fingerprint at a crime scene.
Oh, I love it.
That completely changes the timeline.
Yeah.
Right?
It's a game changer.
So tell me more about these treaty parallels.
Oh, there's so much to tell.
Give me the highlights.
Well, okay, so a typical Hittite treaty starts with a preamble.
Okay.
Which introduces the great king and all his titles.
Like a who's who.
Yeah, think of it like the who's who section of the contract.
Okay.
And then you have a historical prologue.
Okay.
Which reminds the vassal of all the good things the king has done for them.
Okay, so setting the stage for why they owe the king their loyalty.
Exactly. It's all about establishing that history of benevolence.
Okay. Makes sense.
Right.
So then what comes next?
Well, then comes the heart of the treaty.
Okay, the good stuff.
The stipulations.
Okay.
Which are all the rules and obligations that the vassal has to follow.
Got it.
And these are often divided into two categories.
Nice.
The basic overarching ones.
Right.
And then the more detailed specific rules.
It's like a constitution with all its amendments.
Exactly. You got it.
Okay, so what else?
Well, some treaties also had provisions.
Okay.
For depositing the text in a sanctuary.
Oh, interesting.
And reading it aloud regularly.
Like a public declaration.
Yeah.
Wow.
And of course, you have witnesses to the treaty.
Witnesses.
Usually the gods.
Right.
And then a section outlining the blessings for obedience and the curses for disobedience.
So making sure everyone knows what's at stake.
Exactly. It's all about accountability.
Okay. I am starting to see how this connects to Deuteronomy. But we're running out of time for this part of the deep dive.
Oh, man.
But before we go, can you give us a quick preview?
Absolutely.
Of how Klein actually matches these treaty elements to Deuteronomy.
Oh, yeah. So let's just say that Deuteronomy's opening words.
Okay.
Those famous lines, these are the words.
Yeah.
Are practically identical.
Really?
To how a Hittite treaty would begin.
Oh, wow.
It's a clue that's hard to ignore.
That's a pretty big clue.
It is.
All right, so we'll dive deeper into Klein's analysis in the next part of our deep dive.
Can't wait.
Welcome back.
Yes, we're back.
Before we got lost in the ancient world of Hittite treaties.
Oh, yeah, those Hittites.
Our expert was about to blow our minds.
I hope so.
With how these contracts actually line up with the Book of Deuteronomy.
It's pretty amazing. Yeah we were talking about
how
Hittite treaties had these standard sections.
Right.
The preamble, historical prologue, stipulations, provisions for depositing the text.
Okay.
And then those blessings and curses.
Right, right.
For obedience or disobedience. And if we look closely at Deuteronomy, we see these same elements woven throughout the text.
Wait, seriously?
It's true.
Okay, give me some example.
All right, well, for starters, remember those famous opening words of Deuteronomy? These are the words.
Yeah.
Those are almost identical
really?
To how Hittite treaties would begin.
Oh, wow.
It's like their version of hear ye, hear ye.
So right off the bat, we have this stylistic echo that suggests, maybe Deuteronomy is following a treaty format.
It's a possibility.
Okay, I'm intrigued. What else?
All right, so then there's that whole section
in
Deuteronomy, chapters 27-30, where it talks about the blessings for obedience.
Right.
And the curses for disobedience.
Yeah.
For a long time, some scholars saw that as kind of an afterthought.
Oh, really?
Like it was tacked on later.
Just kind of extra.
Yeah. But when you view Deuteronomy as a treaty,
right,
those chapters suddenly make perfect sense.
Oh, I see.
It's like the terms and conditions of the agreement.
Yeah.
Laying out the consequences for breaking the covenant.
Right. Right. Like you better follow these rules.
Exactly. Exactly. There are stakes involved.
Okay. All right. So then what about that Song of Witness?
Oh, yeah, in Deuteronomy.
Chapters 31 and 32.
That's a good one.
That's such a powerful section.
It is.
Full of poetry and warnings for the future.
Powerful stuff.
But how does that fit into the whole treaty idea?
Well, in Hittite treaties, you would often have the gods serving as witnesses to the agreement.
Right, to make it official.
Right, it was a way of adding divine authority
uh-huh.
to the contract.
But in Deuteronomy...
Yeah.
They don't call on a bunch of gods.
Right.
Right? They have this Song of Witness.
Exactly.
That acts as a prophetic warning to future generations.
It's like they adapted the concept.
Oh.
To fit their monotheistic beliefs.
Instead of multiple gods, they have this powerful song.
Right.
Speaking for God's covenant with Israel.
Exactly. Pretty clever.
It's really clever. I love that.
It highlights how Deuteronomy, while drawing on this ancient treaty structure also brings in its own unique theological elements.
Right. It's not just a copycat.
Exactly.
Okay. So we've got the opening words,
uh-huh.
the blessings and curses,
yep.
the Song of Witness.
Uh-huh.
Any other big parallels?
Oh, there's one more that's pretty significant.
Okay, lay it on me.
Remember how at the end of Deuteronomy, Moses transfers leadership to Joshua?
Yeah, the passing of the torch.
Exactly.
To the next generation.
And you know what? In the Hittite world, when a king died and his son took over, they would often renew the treaty with the vassal.
Interesting.
It was a way of ensuring continuity.
Right, making sure everything stays in order.
Exactly, reaffirming the agreement.
With the new ruler.
Right.
So Moses transferring leadership to Joshua could be seen as kind of a treaty renewal.
Precisely.
Making sure the covenant continues with the new generation.
You got it.
This is amazing.
It's details like this that make Klein's argument so compelling.
Right. So by understanding this ancient treaty form, things that might seem kind of random or extraneous.
Yeah, like they didn't belong.
In Deuteronomy, suddenly click into place.
Like puzzle pieces.
Exactly.
It all makes sense.
This is blowing my mind.
I know, right?
But, you know, would everyone agree with this interpretation?
Well, of course, no theory is perfect.
Right.
Some critics might argue that the parallels between Deuteronomy and Hittite treaties are interesting, but not definitive proof.
Sure.
They might say it's just a coincidence.
Okay.
Or that Deuteronomy is borrowing from a broader cultural trend.
Right, right.
Of using treaty language.
Okay.
But even if Deuteronomy isn't a strict legal treaty,
yeah,
in the same sense as those Hittite documents,
right,
the parallels are still too striking to ignore.
Right. You can't just dismiss them.
Exactly.
Okay. So it's like those historical dramas.
Oh, I love those.
Where they find a secret message written in code.
Right.
Even if we don't know for sure who wrote it.
Yeah.
We can still learn a lot by deciphering the message.
Exactly.
And understanding the context in which it was written.
That's what it's all about.
Okay. So the key takeaway here is that Klein's work.
Yeah.
Has opened up a whole new way of looking at Deuteronomy.
That's a fresh perspective.
Okay. I'm officially on board with the treaty idea.
All right.
But remember Manly and his deep dive into the law codes?
Oh, yeah. Manly the Codebreaker.
Did he find anything else?
He did.
That supports the idea of Deuteronomy being a Mosaic document?
He found several things, actually.
Okay, give me the juicy details.
So remember how Wellhausen thought
yeah.
that the law evolved over time from simpler to more complex?
Yeah.
Well, Manly found several examples where this supposed evolution just doesn't hold up.
Really?
Like finding a smartphone in an ancient Egyptian tomb.
What?
It messes up the whole timeline.
Oh, that's a good one.
Right.
So Manly's research is basically showing that the development of the law is much more complicated.
It's not a straight line.
Than Wellhausen imagined.
Yeah, it's more like a tangled web.
So it's not this neat linear progression.
Exactly.
And that opens up the possibility that Deuteronomy...
Yes.
With its sophisticated laws and theological reflections, could have been written much earlier than Wellhausen thought.
It's possible.
This is getting really exciting.
I know. It's like we're building a case
yeah.
brick by brick.
For the idea that Deuteronomy
right.
could be a Mosaic document.
The evidence is mounting.
But before we wrap up,
yeah,
we have to circle back to Howarda.
Oh, Howarda.
And his work on centralized worship.
Right. He really poked some holes.
He did.
In Wellhausen's theory.
But I'm still a bit fuzzy on the details.
Oh.
Can you walk me through it again?
Sure. So Wellhausen's argument hinged on the idea that Deuteronomy introduced this whole concept of one central sanctuary for worship.
Right.
Something that he believed was a later development in Israelite religion.
Okay.
He pointed to Deuteronomy chapter 12 as the smoking gun.
Right. Right.
Claiming it mandated worship. Only at a central location.
Okay.
Which he then linked to the reforms of King Josiah.
Right.
In 621 BC.
So basically, Wellhausen was saying
yeah.
Deuteronomy couldn't have been written by Moses because it reflects these later religious ideas about centralized worship.
Exactly.
Okay.
But that's where Howarda's analysis is so important.
Okay, yeah.
He carefully examines Deuteronomy 12.
Uh-huh.
And argues that it's not actually mandating exclusive worship at one central location.
Really?
Instead, it's addressing a very specific problem.
Yes.
The danger of Canaanite religious practices. Infiltrating Israelite worship.
So it's not about centralizing worship for
right.
the sake of centralizing it.
Exactly.
But about purifying worship.
Yeah.
Making sure that it's directed to the one true God.
You got it.
Okay, so Deuteronomy 12 is basically saying destroy the Canaanite places of worship and don't imitate their practices.
Right, but it's not saying
okay.
you can only worship at this one specific spot.
Oh, that makes a lot more sense.
It's about the quality of the worship,
yeah,
not the location.
So Deuteronomy is concerned with the purity of worship, not the location.
Exactly.
That completely changes how we read that passage.
It does.
And it means that the supposed link
yeah.
between Deuteronomy
right.
and the later reforms of King Josiah starts to weaken.
Yeah, it does.
This is incredible.
I know. It's like Howarda took a magnifying glass
right.
to Deuteronomy 12.
And revealed a whole new layer of meaning.
And a whole new understanding.
That had been overlooked.
It's amazing what a close reading can reveal.
But I'm curious, yeah. does anything else support Howarda's interpretation?
Yes, as a matter of fact.
Really?
Archaeology has actually uncovered evidence of multiple cultic sites in Israel.
So they were worshiping in multiple places.
It seems so.
During the period before Josiah's reforms.
Right, which suggests
okay.
that centralized worship wasn't the norm back then.
Wow. So the archaeological record is backing up what Howarda is saying
it
about
is.
Deuteronomy 12.
That's right.
That's pretty amazing.
It is. It's like the physical evidence is confirming
yeah.
the textual analysis.
This is what's so exciting about biblical scholarship.
I know. It's like a detective story.
We have all these different pieces of the puzzle.
Right.
Textual analysis, historical context,
archaeological
evidence.
All coming together.
And when we put them all together, they can help us create a more complete
and nuanced.
A nuanced understanding of the Bible.
It's a beautiful thing.
This is just blowing my mind.
I know, it's a lot to take in.
Who knew that the authorship of Deuteronomy would be so fascinating?
You never know where a deep dive will take you.
We've gone from ancient Hittite treaties to code-breaking law codes to archaeological digs.
It's been quite a journey.
What a journey.
It has.
But before we get too carried away, we have one more scholar to talk about.
Oh, right.
McConville, our theological detective.
Okay.
He noticed something really interesting about the laws in Deuteronomy.
Okay.
That sheds even more light on the question of authorship.
This is getting good.
But unfortunately, we're out of time for this part of the deep dive.
Oh.
We'll have to save McConville's insights for our final segment.
Yeah, wait.
Stay tuned. Okay, so we're back for the final part of our Deuteronomy deep dive.
The grand finale.
We've explored Hittite treaties.
Those were fascinating.
I know, right? We've cracked the code of ancient law.
It was like being a code breaker.
And even ventured into archaeology.
It's been a wild ride.
But we left off with this tantalizing cliffhanger.
Oh, right. McConville.
The theological detective.
What did he find?
He had some really fascinating observations about the laws themselves.
So not just the form of the text.
No, not just the structure.
But the content, the actual laws.
The laws themselves.
Right. What did he discover?
Well, McConville approached Deuteronomy from a slightly different angle.
Okay.
He wasn't just looking at the form or the structure, but also the content.
Okay.
The specific laws and how they reflected the theological concerns.
Right. The why behind the laws.
Exactly.
So what kind of why did he uncover?
Well, he argues that the laws in Deuteronomy are deeply intertwined with the historical context of Israel on the verge of entering the Promised Land.
I see. So the laws are addressing the specific challenges and temptations.
Precisely.
They would face as they transition from this nomadic life in the wilderness to a settled life in Canaan.
Right. It's a whole new set of circumstances.
Okay. So if the laws reflect the concerns of this specific historical moment.
Yes.
The moment of entering the Promised Land.
Wouldn't that point towards Mosaic authorship?
It would.
I mean, Moses was the one leading them into Canaan.
He was.
And McConville backs this up with some compelling examples.
Like what?
Well, for instance, he points to the laws about kingship.
Oh, kingship.
In Deuteronomy 17.
Okay.
These laws seem to anticipate the dangers of a future monarchy.
Okay.
Warning against, like, the accumulation of wealth, horses, foreign wives, all things that later kings of Israel struggled with.
It's like he's giving them a heads up.
Right. Like, hey, if you choose to have a king someday, here are some things to watch out for.
That's good advice.
Right. That's pretty insightful.
It is.
Especially if you believe Moses was speaking from the perspective of someone about to lead them into a new land.
That's McConville's argument.
So this kind of foresight
makes
more sense if Deuteronomy was written during Moses' lifetime.
Yeah, as he was preparing them for what was to come.
This is amazing. So we've got Howerda debunking the idea that Deuteronomy mandated centralized worship.
Big win for Moses there.
Manly showing that the law codes are more interconnected than Wellhausen thought.
Like a tapestry.
Klein revealing the treaty structure.
The Hittite connection.
And now McConville highlighting how the laws themselves fit the historical context of Moses and the Israelites.
It's all coming together.
Entering the Promised Land.
Like pieces of a puzzle.
It's like all these different threads of evidence are weaving together
to form a picture,
to create this tapestry
that supports the traditional view of Mosaic authorship.
That's incredible.
It's pretty compelling.
The debate will continue, of course.
It always does.
And there will always be those who disagree.
That's part of scholarship.
But it's important to recognize that the evidence for Mosaic authorship is stronger and more nuanced than a lot of people realize.
It's worth considering.
This has been such an eye-opening journey. I feel like I've gained a whole new appreciation.
I have too.
For Deuteronomy and the complexity of biblical scholarship.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
We started with the simple question.
Right.
Who wrote Deuteronomy?
A question with a very complex answer.
And ended up exploring ancient treaties, deciphering legal codes, even venturing into archaeology.
Not theology.
And theology.
That's all connected.
So what's the takeaway for our listeners?
What should they be thinking about?
As they go forth into the world armed with this newfound knowledge.
Well, I think the most important takeaway is this. Don't be afraid to challenge assumptions.
Okay.
And explore different perspectives.
I like that.
The world of biblical scholarship
yeah.
is full of these fascinating debates and ongoing discoveries.
It's a never-ending journey.
What we think we know today might change tomorrow.
That's true.
As new evidence emerges
right.
or new interpretations are proposed.
That's such an important point.
It is.
It's so easy to get stuck in our own ways of thinking.
It is. We have to be open to new ideas.
But there's always more to learn, more to explore, more to discover.
And who knows?
Yeah.
Maybe our listener will be the one to uncover the next groundbreaking insight.
Oh, I love it.
Into the authorship of Deuteronomy.
That's what I love about this show.
Yeah.
It's all about sparking curiosity
right.
and empowering listeners to become their own deep divers.
Well said.
Thanks for joining us on this incredible journey.
It's been a pleasure.
Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep those brains buzzing.
I'll be doing the same.